This time, even more intensely, more passionately. "Please don't look at me like that," she said, turning away. "Why not?" "Because I can see what you're thinking." Anakin broke the tension, or tried to, with a laugh. "Oh, so you have Jedi powers too." Padme looked past the young Padawan for a moment, glimpsing Dorme, who was watching with obvious concern and not even trying to hide her interest anymore. And Padme understood that concern, given the strange and unexpected road this conversation had taken. She looked squarely at Anakin again and said, with no room for debate, "It makes me feel uncomfortable." Anakin relented and looked away. "Sorry, m'lady," he said professionally, and he stepped back, allowing her to resume her packing. Just the bodyguard again. But he wasn't. Padme knew. No matter how much she wished it were true, it were true. On a water-washed, wind-lashed world, far to the most remote edges of the Outer Rim, a father and his son sat on a skirt of shining black metal, watching carefully in the few somewhat calm pools created by the current swirling about the gigantic caryatid that climbed out of the turbulent ocean. The rain had let up a bit, a rare occasion in this watery place, allowing for some calm surface area at least, and the pair stared hard, searching for the meter-long dark silhouettes of rollerfish. They were on the lowest skirt of one of the great pillars that supported Topoka City, the greatest city on all of Kamino, a place of sleek structures all rounded to deflect the continual wind, rather than flat-faced to battle against it. Kamino had been designed, or upgraded at least, by many of the best architects the galaxy could offer, who understood well that the best way to battle planetary elements was to subtly dodge them. Towering, transparent steel windows looked out from every portal. The father, Django, often wondered why the Kaminoans, tall and thin pasty white creatures with huge almond-shaped eyes set in oblong heads on necks as long as his arm, wanted so many windows. What was there to see on this violent world, other than rolling waters and nearly constant downpours? Still, even Kamino had its better moments. It was all relative, Django supposed. Thus, when he saw that it was not raining very hard, he had taken his boy outside. Django tapped his son on the shoulder and nodded toward one of the quiet eddies, and the younger one, his face showing all the exuberance of a 10-year-old boy, lifted his pocker, an ion burst-powered atlatl, and took deadly aim. He didn't use the laser sighting unit, which automatically adjusted for watery refraction. No, this kill was to be a test of his skill alone. He exhaled deeply, as his father had taught him, using the technique to go perfectly steady, and then, as the prey turned sidelong, he snapped his arm forward, throwing the missile. Barely a meter from the boy's extended hand, the back of the missile glowed briefly, a sudden and short burst of power that shot it off like a blaster bolt, knifing through the water and taking the fish in the side, its barbed head driving through. With a shout of joy, the boy twisted the atlatl handle, locking the nearly invisible but tremendously strong line, and then, when the fish squirmed away enough to pull the line taut, the boy slowly and deliberately turned the handle, reeling in his catch. "Well done," Django congratulated. "But if you had hit it a centimeter forward, you would have skewered the primary muscle, just below the gill, and rendered it completely helpless." The boy nodded, unperturbed that his father, his mentor, could always find fault, even in success. The boy knew that his beloved father did so only because it forced him to strive for perfection. And in a dangerous galaxy, perfection allowed for survival. The boy loved his father even more, for caring enough to criticize. Django went tense suddenly, sensing a movement nearby, a footfall perhaps, or just a smell, something to tell the finely attuned bounty hunter that he and his boy were not alone. There weren't many enemies to be found on Kamino, except far out in the watery wastes, where giant tentacled creatures roamed. Here, there was little life above the water, other than the Kaminoans themselves. And so Django wasn't surprised when he saw that the newcomer was one of them. Ton Hui, his usual contact with the Kaminoans.
"Greetings, Master Django," the tall, lithe creature said,
holding up a slim arm and hand in a gesture of peace and friendship. Django nodded but didn't smile. Why had Tonwi come out here? The Kaminoans were hardly ever out of their city of globes. And why would she interrupt Django when he was with his son? You have been scarce within the sector of late, Tonwi remarked.
Better things to do.
With your child?
In response, Django looked over at the boy, who was lining up another roller fish. Or at least he was appearing to, Django recognized. And the insight brought a knowing nod of satisfaction to the crusty bounty hunter. He had taught his son well the art of deception and deflection, of appearing to do one thing while in reality doing something quite different. Like listening in on the conversation, measuring Tonwi's every word.
The 10th anniversary approaches, the Kaminoan explained.
Django turned back to her with a sour expression.
You think I don't know Boba's birthday?
If Tonwi was fazed at all by the sharp retort, the delicately featured Kaminoan didn't show it.
We are ready to begin again.
Django looked back at Boba, one of his thousands of children, but the only one who was a perfect clone, an exact replica, with no genetic manipulation to make him more obedient. And the only one who hadn't been artificially aged. The group that had been created beside Boba had all reached maturity now, were adult warriors in perfect health. Django had thought that policy of accelerating the aging process a mistake. Wasn't experience as much a part of attaining warrior skill as genetics? But he hadn't complained openly to the Kaminoans about it. He had been hired to do a job, to serve as the source, and questioning the process wasn't in his job description. Tonwi cocked her head a bit to the side, eyes blinking slowly. Django recognized her expression as curiosity, and it nearly brought a chuckle bubbling to his lips. The Kaminoans were much more alike than were humans, especially humans from different planets. Perhaps their singular concept, their commonness within their own species, was a part of their typical reproductive process, which now included a fair amount of genetic manipulation, if not outright cloning. As a society, they were practically of one mind and one heart. Tonwi seemed genuinely perplexed, and so she was, to see a human with so little apparent regard for other humans, clones or not. Of course, hadn't the Kaminoans just created an army for the Republic? There wouldn't be wars without some disagreement, now would there? But that, too, held little interest for Django. He was a solitary bounty hunter, a recluse, or he would have been, if not for Boba. Django didn't care a whit about politics or war or this army of his clones. If every one of them was slaughtered, then so be it. He had no attachment to any. He looked to the side as he considered that. To any except for Boba, of course. Other than that, though, this was just a job. Well-paying and easy enough. Financially, he couldn't have asked for more. But more importantly, only the Kaminoans could have given him Boba. Not just a son, but an exact replica. Boba would give Django the pleasure of seeing all that he might have become had he grown up with a loving and caring father, a mentor who cared enough to criticize, to force him to perfection. He was as good as it got concerning bounty hunters, concerning warriors, but he had no doubt that Boba, bred and trained for perfection, would far outshine him to become one of the greatest warriors the galaxy had ever known. This, then, was Django Fett's greatest reward, right here, sitting with his son, his young replica, sharing quiet moments. Quiet moments within the tumult that had been Django Fett's entire life, surviving the trials of the Outer Rim alone, practically from the day he learned to walk. Each trial had made him stronger, had made him more perfect, had honed the skills that he would now pass along to Boba. There was no one better in all the galaxy to teach his son. When Django Fett wanted you caught, you were caught. When Django Fett wanted you were dead. No, not when Django wanted those things. This was never personal. The hunting, the killing, it was all a job. And among the most valuable of lessons Django had learned early on was how to become dispassionate. Completely so. That was his greatest weapon. He looked at Ton Wee, then turned to grin at his son. Django could be dispassionate, except for those times when he could spend time alone with Boba. With Boba, there was pride, and there was love, and Django had to work constantly to keep both of those potential weaknesses at a minimum. While he loved his son dearly, because he loved his son dearly, Django had been teaching him those same attributes of dispassion, even callousness, from his earliest days.
"We will commence the process again as soon as you are ready," Ton Wee remarked,
bringing Django back from his contemplations. "Don't you have enough of the material to do it without me?"
"Well, since you are here anyway, we would like you to be involved," Ton Wee said. "The original host is always the best choice."
Django rolled his eyes at the thought of the needles and the probing, but he did nod his agreement. This was really an easy job, considering the rewards.
"Whenever you are ready."
Ton Wee bowed and turned and walked away. "If you wait for that, you'll be waiting forever," Django thought. But he kept quiet, and again he turned to Boba, motioning for the boy to put his atlatl back to work. "Because now I have all that I wanted," Django mused, watching Boba's fluid motions, his eyes darting about, searching for the next roller fish. The industrial sector of Coruscant held perhaps the greatest freight docks in all the galaxy, with a line of bulky transports coming in continually, huge floating cranes ready to meet them and unload the millions of tons of supplies necessary to keep alive the city planet, which long ago had become too populous to support itself through its own resources. The efficiency of these docks was nothing short of amazing, and yet the place was still tumultuous, and sometimes gridlocked by the sheer number of docking ships and floating cranes. This was also a place for living passengers, the peasantry of Coruscant, catching cheap rides on freighters outbound, thousands and thousands of people looking to escape the sheer frenzy that had become the world. Blended into that throng, Anakin and Padme walked along, dressed in simple brown tunics and breeches, the garb of outland refugees. They walked side by side to the shuttle exit as they approached the dock and walkway that would take them to one of the gigantic transports. Captain Typho, Dorme, and Obi-Wan stood waiting for them at that exit door. "Be safe, m'lady," Captain Typho said, with genuine concern. It was clear that he was not thrilled with allowing Padme out of his sight and control. He handed a pair of small luggage bags over to Anakin and gave a nod of confidence to the young Jedi.
"Thank you, Captain," Padme replied,
her voice thick with gratitude.
"Take good care of Dorme. The threat will be on you two now."
"He'll be safe with me," Dorme put in quickly. Padme smiled, appreciating the small attempt at levity. Then she embraced her handmaiden in a great and tight hug, squeezing all the tighter when she heard Dorme start to weep.
"You'll be fine," Padme whispered into the other woman's ear. "It's not me, m'lady. I worry about you. What if they realize you've left the capital?"
Padme moved back to arm's length and managed a smile as she looked over to Anakin. "Then my Jedi protector will have to prove how good he is." Dorme gave a nervous chuckle and wiped a tear from her eye as she smiled and nodded. Off to the side, Anakin held his smile within, deciding consciously to wear a posture that exuded confidence and control. But inside, he was thrilled to hear Padme's compliments coming his way. Obi-Wan shattered that warmth, pulling the young Padawan off to the side.
"You stay on Naboo," the knight said. "Don't attract attention. Do absolutely nothing without checking in with me or the council."
"Yes, master," Anakin answered obediently. But inside, he was churning, wanting to lash out at Obi-Wan. Do nothing, absolutely nothing, without checking in, without asking for permission? Hadn't he earned a bit more respect than that? Hadn't he proven himself a bit more resourceful? A Padawan to be trusted?
"I will get to the bottom of this plot quickly, m'lady," he heard Obi-Wan say to Padme.
Anakin seethed inwardly.
Hadn't that been exactly the course he had suggested to his master when they had first been assigned to watch over the senator?
You'll be back here in no time, Obi-Wan assured her.
I will be most grateful for your speed, Master Jedi.
Anakin didn't appreciate hearing Padme speak of any gratitude at all toward Obi-Wan. At least, he didn't want Padme to elevate Obi-Wan's importance in all of this above his own.
Time to go, he said, striding forward.
I know, Padme answered him, but she didn't seem pleased.
Anakin reminded himself not to take it personally. Padme felt that her duty was here. She wasn't thrilled with running off planet, and she wasn't thrilled with having another of her dear handmaidens stepping into the line of fire in her stead, especially with images of dead Corday so fresh in her mind. Padme and Dorme shared another hug. Anakin took up the luggage and led the way off the speeder bus onto a landing where R2-D2 waited.
May the Force be with you, Obi-Wan said.
May the Force be with you, Master. Anakin meant every word of it. He wanted Obi-Wan to find out who was behind the assassination attempts, to make the galaxy safe for Padme once again. But he had to admit that he hoped it wouldn't happen too quickly. His duty now put him right beside the woman he loved, and he wouldn't be happy if this assignment proved a short one, if duty pulled him away from her yet again.
Suddenly, I'm afraid, Padme said to him, as they walked away, heading toward the giant star freighter that would take them to Naboo.
Behind the pair, R2-D2 rolled along, tootling cheerily.
This is my first assignment on my own.
I am too.
Anakin turned about, taking Padme's gaze with his own, and grinned widely.
But don't worry, we've got R2 with us.
Back at the bus, waiting for it to take them back to the main city, the three left behind watched Anakin, Padme, and R2-D2 blend into the throng of the vast spaceport.
I hope he doesn't try anything foolish, Obi-Wan said.
The mere fact that he would speak so openly concerning his student showed Captain Typho how much the Jedi Knight had come to trust him.
I'd be more concerned about her doing something than him, Typho replied.
He shook his head, his expression serious.
She's not one to follow orders.
Like-minded traveling companions, Dorme observed.
Obi-Wan and Typho turned to regard her, and Typho shook his head helplessly again.
Obi-Wan didn't disagree with Dorme's assessment, however innocently she meant it. Padme Amidala was a stubborn one indeed, one of strong and independent thinking, and more than willing to trust her own judgment above that of others, whatever their position and experience. But of the pair who had just left the speeder bus, she wasn't the most headstrong. It was not a comforting thought.
Chapter 11. The Great Jedi Temple was a place of reflection and of hard training, and it was also a place of information. The Jedi were traditionally the keepers of the peace, and also of knowledge. Beneath their high ceilings, off the main corridor of the temple, stood the glass cubicles, the analysis rooms, filled with droids of various shapes and sizes and various purposes. Obi-Wan Kenobi was thinking of Anakin and Padme as he made his way through the temple. He wondered, not for the first time, and certainly not for the last, about the wisdom of sending Anakin off with the senator. The eagerness with which the Padawan had embraced his new duty set off warning bells in Obi-Wan's head, but he had allowed it to go forth anyway, mostly because he knew that he'd be too busy following the leads he hoped he could garner here, uncovering the source of Amidala's troubles. The analysis cubicles were busy this day, as they were nearly every day, with students and masters alike, hard at their studies. Obi-Wan found one open cubicle with an SP-4 analysis droid, the type he needed. He sat down in front of the console, and the droid responded immediately, sliding open a tray.
Place the subject for analysis on the sensor tray, please, the droid's metallic voice said.
Obi-Wan was already moving, pulling forth the toxic dart that had killed the subcontracting bounty hunter. As soon as the tray receded, the screen before Obi-Wan lit up and began scrolling through a series of diagrams and streams of data.
It's a toxic dart, the Jedi explained to the SP-4. I need to know where it came from and who made it.
One moment, please.
More diagrams rolled by, more reams of data scrolling,
and then the screen paused, showing a somewhat similar dart. But it wasn't a match, and the scrolling started again. Images of the dart flashed up before Obi-Wan, superimposed with diagrams of similar objects. Nothing matched. The screen went blank. The tray slid back out.
As you can see on your screen, subject weapon does not exist in any known culture,
SP4 explained.
Markings cannot be identified. Probably self-made by a warrior not associated with any known culture. Stand away from the sensor tray, please.
Excuse me, could you try again, please?
There was no hiding the frustration in Obi-Wan's voice.
Master Jedi, our records are very thorough. They cover 80% of the galaxy. If I can't tell you where it came from, nobody can.
Obi-Wan picked up the dart, looked at the droid, and sighed, not so sure that he agreed with that particular assessment. Thanks for your assistance, he said. He wondered if SP-4s were equipped to understand the inflections of sarcasm. You may not be able to figure this out, but I think I know someone who might.
The odds do not suggest such a possibility.
SP-4 started to reply, and began rolling along with a dissertation about the completeness of its databanks, of its unequaled search capabilities of... It didn't matter, for Obi-Wan was long gone, walking briskly along the great corridor and out of the Jedi Temple. He left without a word to anyone, his thoughts turned inward, trying to find some focus. He needed these answers, and quickly. He knew that instinctively, but he had a nagging feeling that it wasn't necessarily about Senator Amidala's safety. He sensed that something more might be at stake here, though what it was, he could only guess. Anakin's mindset? A greater plot against the Republic? Or perhaps he was just being jumpy because the normally reliable SB-4 droid hadn't been able to help him at all. He needed answers, and conventional methods of obtaining them wouldn't suffice, apparently. But Obi-Wan Kenobi was not a conventional Jedi in many ways. Although he tended to be reserved, especially when dealing with his Padawan, his former master Qui-Gon Jinn had left a mark on Obi-Wan. He knew where to get his answers. He took a speeder to the business section of Coco Town, far from where he and Anakin had caught the would-be assassin. Obi-Wan stopped his vehicle and exited to the street. He moved to one small building, its windows foggy, its walls metallic and brightly painted. Lettering above the door named the place, and though he could not read that particular script, Obi-Wan knew well what it said. Dex's Diner. He smiled. He hadn't seen Dex in a long time. Far too long, he mused as he entered. The inside of the diner was fairly typical of the establishments, along the lower level, with booths set against the walls and many small freestanding circular tables surrounded by tall stools. There was a counter area as well, partly lined with stools and partly open. A variety of beings standing and leaning against it. A tough crowd indeed, Obi-Wan knew. Freighter drivers and dock workers, people who still use their muscles in a galaxy grown soft through technology. The Jedi moved to one small table, sliding onto its stool as a waitress droid wiped the table down with a rag.
Can I help you?
The droid asked. I'm looking for Dexter. The waitress droid made a rather unpleasant sound. Obi-Wan just smiled. I do need to speak with Dexter.
What do you want him for?
He's not in trouble, the Jedi assured her. It's personal. The droid stared at him for a short while, sizing him up. Then, with a shake of her head, she moved to the open serving hatch behind the counter.
Someone to see you, honey,
she said.
A Jedi, by the looks of him.
A huge head poked through the open hatchway almost immediately, accompanied by a line of gray steam. A wide smile on a mouth wide enough to swallow Obi-Wan's head whole, with huge block teeth, grew on the immense face as he set his gaze on the visitor.
Obi-Wan!
Hey, Dex, Obi-Wan replied, standing and moving to the counter.
Take a seat, old buddy. Be right with you.
Obi-Wan glanced around. The waitress droid had gone about her business, tending to other customers. He moved to a booth just to the side of the counter.
You want a cup of RDs?
The droid asked, her demeanor much more accommodating. Thank you. She moved off toward the counter, slipping aside as the infamous Dexter Jetster moved through the counter door, walking with a stiff gait. He was an impressive sort, a necklace mound of flesh, dwarfing most of the toughies who frequented his establishment. His great belly poked out beneath his grimy shirt and breeches. He was bald and sweaty, and though he had seen many years and did not move fluidly any longer, with too many old injuries slowing him, Dexter Jetster was obviously not a creature anyone wanted to fight, especially since he was possessed of four huge arms, each with a massive fist that could fully bust a man's face. Obi-Wan noted the many respectful glances that went his way as he moved to the booth.
Hey, old buddy.
Hey, Dex. Long time. With great effort, Dexter managed to squeeze himself into the seat opposite Obi-Wan. The waitress droid was back by then, setting two steaming mugs of RDs in front of the old friends.
So, my friend, what can I do for you?
Dexter asked. And it was obvious to Obi-Wan that Dex genuinely wanted to help. Obi-Wan was hardly surprised. He didn't always approve of Dexter's antics, of the seedy diner and the many fights, but he knew Dex to be among the most loyal of friends that anyone could ever ask for. Dex would crush the life out of an enemy, but would give his own life for someone he cared about. That was the code among the Star Wanderers, and one that Obi-Wan could truly appreciate. In many, many ways, being here with Dex appealed to the Jedi Knight much more than the time he had to spend among the ruling elite. You can tell me what this is, Obi-Wan answered. He put the dart on the table, watching Dex all the time, noting how the being quickly placed his mug back down, his eyes widening as he regarded the curious and distinctive item.
Well, what do you know?
Dex said quietly, as if he could hardly draw breath. He picked up the dart delicately, almost reverently, the weapon nearly disappearing within the folds of his fat fingers.
I ain't seen one of these since I was prospecting on Subterro, beyond the Outer Rim.
Do you know where it came from? Dexter placed the dart down before Obi-Wan.
This baby belongs to them cloners. What you got here is a Kamino saber dart.
Kamino saber dart? Obi-Wan echoed. I wonder why it didn't show up in our analysis archive. Dex poked down at the dart with a stubby finger.
It's these funny little cuts on the side that give it away, he explained. Those analysis droids you got over there only focus on symbols, you know. I should think you Jedi have more respect for the difference between knowledge and wisdom.
Well, Dex, if droids could think, there'd be none of us here, would there? Obi-Wan answered with a laugh. The Jedi Knight sobered quickly, though, remembering the gravity of his mission. Kamino. Doesn't sound familiar. Is it part of the Republic?
No, it's beyond the Outer Rim. I'd say about 12 parsecs outside the Rishi Maze, toward the south. It should be easy to find, even for those droids in your archive. These Kaminoans keep to themselves, mostly. They're cloners. Good ones, too.
Obi-Wan picked up the dart again, holding it between them, his elbow resting on the table. Cloners? He asked. Are they friendly?
It depends.
On what? The Jedi looked past the dart as he asked, and the grin on Dexter's face gave him his answer before it was spoken aloud.
On how good your manners are, and how big your pocketbook is.
Obi-Wan looked back at the saber dart, hardly surprised. Chapter 12. Senator Padme Amidala, formerly Queen Amidala of Naboo, certainly wasn't used to traveling in this manner. The freighter held one class, steerage, and in truth, it was nothing more than a cargo ship, with several great open holds more suitable to inanimate cargo than to living beings. The lighting was terrible and the smell was worse, though whether the odor came from the ship itself or the hordes of emigrants, beings of many, many species, Padme did not know. Nor did she care. In some ways, Padme was truly enjoying this voyage. She knew that she should be back on Coruscant, fighting the efforts to create a Republic army. But somehow, she felt relaxed here. Felt free. Free of responsibility, free to just be Padme for a while instead of Senator Amidala. Moments such as these were rare for her, and had been since she was a child. All of her life, it seemed, had been spent in public service. All of her focus had always been for the greater, the public good, with hardly any time ever being given just to Padme, to her needs and her desires. The senator didn't regret that reality of her life. She was proud of her accomplishments, but more than that, even, she felt a profound sense of warmth, of community, of belonging to something greater than herself. Still, these moments when the responsibility was lifted were undeniably enjoyable. She looked over at Anakin, who was sleeping somewhat restlessly. She could see him now, not as a Jedi Padawan and her protector, but just as a young man, a handsome young man, and one whose actions repeatedly professed his love for her. A dangerous young man, to be sure. A Jedi who was thinking about things he should not. A man who was inevitably following the call of his heart above that of pragmatism and propriety. And all for her. Padme couldn't deny the attractiveness of that. She and Anakin were on similar roads of public service. She as a senator, he as a Jedi Padawan. But he was showing rebellion against the present course, or at least against the master who was leading him along the present course, as Padme never had. But hadn't she wanted to? Hadn't Padme Amidala wanted to be just Padme? Once in a while, at least? She smiled widely and pointedly turned from Anakin, scanning the gloomy room for signs of her other companion. She finally spotted R2-D2 in a food line, where he stuck out among the throng of living creatures. Just before the droid, servers ladled up bowls of bland-looking mush, and each being who took one inevitably gave out a low groan of disapproval. Padme watched with amusement as one of the servers began yelling and waving his hand at R2-D2, motioning for the droid to move along.
"No droids in the food line," the server yelled. "Get out of here!"
R2 started past the counter, but stopped suddenly, and a hollow tube came forth from his utilitarian body, hovering over the buffet and sucking up some of the mush and placing it in a storage container for transport to his companions.
"Hey, no droids!" the server yelled again.
R2 took another fast gulp of the mush, reached out with a claw arm to grab a piece of bread, then turned and tootled and rushed away, the server shaking his fist and shouting behind him. The droid came fast across the wide floor, veering to avoid the many sweeping emigrants, making as straight a line as possible toward the beaming Padme.
"No. No,"
came a call beside her. It was Anakin.
"Mom, no!"
Padme turned about quickly, to see that her companion was still asleep, but sweating and thrashing, obviously in the throes of some nightmare.
"Anakin?"
She gave him a little shake.
"No, Mom!"
he cried, pulling away from her, and she looked down to see his feet kicking, as if he was running away from something.
"Anakin,"
Padme said again, more forcefully. She shook him again, harder. His blue eyes blinked open, and he looked about curiously before focusing on Padme.
"What?"
"You seem to be having a nightmare." Anakin continued to stare at her, his expression ranging from curiosity to concern. Padme took a bowl of mush and a piece of bread from R2-D2.
"Are you hungry?"
Anakin took the food as he sat up, rubbing a hand through his hair and shaking his head.
"We went to hyperspace a while ago," she explained.
"How long was I asleep?" Padme smiled at him, trying to comfort him.
"You had a good nap," she answered.
Anakin smoothed the front of his tunic and straightened himself, looking all around, trying to get his bearings.
"I look forward to seeing Naboo again," he remarked, and he shifted, trying to orient himself.
His expression soured as he looked down at the off-white mush, and he crinkled his nose, bending low to sniff it.
"Naboo," he said again, looking back to Padme. "I've thought about it every day since I left. It's by far the most beautiful place I've ever seen."
As he spoke, his eyes bored into her, taking her in deeply. And she blinked and averted her own gaze, unnerved.
"It may not be as you remember it. Time changes perception."
"Sometimes it does," Anakin agreed. And when Padme looked up to see that he was continuing to scrutinize her, She knew what he was talking about. Sometimes for the better. It must be difficult having sworn your life to the Jedi, she said, taking a different tack to pull his gaze off her. Not being able to visit the places you like, or do the things you like, or be with the people I love. Anakin could easily see where she was leading him. Are you allowed to love? Padme asked bluntly. I thought it was forbidden for a Jedi. Attachment is forbidden, Anakin began, his voice dispassionate, as if he was reciting. Possession is forbidden. Compassion, which I would define as unconditional love, is central to a Jedi's life. So you might say, we're encouraged to love. You have changed so much, Padme heard herself saying, and in a tone that seemed inappropriate to her, seemed to invite. She blinked as Anakin turned her words back on her. You haven't changed a bit. You're exactly the way I remember you in my dreams. I doubt if Naboo has changed much either. It hasn't. Padme's voice was breathless. They were too close together. She knew that. She knew that she was in dangerous territory here, both for herself and for Anakin. He was a Padawan learner, a Jedi, and Jedi were not allowed. And what about her? What about all that she had worked so hard for all her adult life? What about the Senate and the all-important vote against the creation of an army? If Padme got involved with a Jedi, the implications concerning her vote would become huge. The army, if one was created, would be made to stand beside the Jedi and their duties. And yet Padme would stand against that army. And so, it was all so complicated. But even more important than that, it was all so dangerous. She thought of her sister then, and their last conversation before Padme had flown back to Coruscant. She thought of Ryu and Pooja. You were dreaming about your mother earlier, she remarked, needing to change the subject. She sat back, putting some distance between her and Anakin, gaining some margin of safety between them. Weren't you? Anakin leaned back and looked away, nodding slowly. I left Tatooine so long ago. My memory of her is fading. He snapped his intense gaze back over Padme. I don't want to lose that memory. I don't want to stop seeing her face. She started to say, I know, and started to lift her hand to stroke his cheek, but she held back and let him continue. I've been seeing her in my dreams. Vivid dreams. Scary dreams. I worry about her. I'd be disappointed in you if you didn't. Padme answered him, her voice soft and full of sympathy. You didn't leave her in the best of circumstances. Anakin winced, as if those words had hurt him. But it was right that you left, Padme reminded him, taking his arm. She held his gaze with her own. Your leaving was what your mother wanted for you, what she needed for you. The opportunity that Qui-Gon offered you gave her hope. That's what a parent needs for her child. To know that he, that you, had been given a chance at a better life. But the dreams. You can't help but feel a little guilty about leaving, I suppose, Padme answered. And Anakin was shaking his head, as if she was missing the point. But she didn't believe that to be the case, so she continued. It's only natural that you'd want your mother off Tatooine, out here with you, perhaps. Or on Naboo, or Coruscant, or someplace that you feel is safer and more beautiful. Trust me, Anakin, she said softly but intently, and she put her hand on his forearm again. You did the right thing in going. For yourself, but more importantly, for your mother. Her expression, so full of compassion, so full of caring, was not one that Anakin Skywalker could argue against. The great port city of Theed was in many ways akin to Coruscant, with freighters and shuttles coming down from the skies in lines. Unlike Coruscant, though, this city on Naboo was soft in appearance, with few towering imposing skyscrapers of hard metal and shining transparasteel. The buildings here were of stone and many other materials, with rounded roof lines and delicate colors. Vines of all sorts were everywhere, crawling up the sides of the buildings, adding vibrancy and scents.
adding comfort.
Anakin and Padme lugged their bags across a familiar square, a place where they had seen battle a decade before against the droids of the Trade Federation. R2-D2 came behind them, rolling along easily, whistling a happy song, as if he were an extension of the comfortable aura of Theed. Padme kept covertly glancing at Anakin, noting the serenity on his face, the widening grin. "If I grew up here, I don't think I'd ever leave," Anakin remarked. Padme laughed. "I doubt that." "No, really. When I started my training, I was very homesick and very lonely. This city and my mom were the only pleasant things I had to think about." Padme's expression turned to one of curiosity and confusion. Anakin's time here had been spent mostly in deadly battle. Had he so obsessed about her, about Naboo, that even the bad memories paled against his warm feelings? "The problem was," Anakin went on, "the more I thought about my mom, the worse I felt. But I would feel better if I thought about Naboo and the palace." He didn't say it outright, but Padme knew that what he really meant was that he felt better when he thought about her, or at least that he would include her in those pleasant thoughts. "The way the palace shimmers in the sunlight, the way the air always smells of flowers, and the soft sound of the distant waterfalls," Padme added. She could not deny the sincerity in Anakin's voice and in his words, and she found herself agreeing and embracing that truth of Naboo, despite her resolve to stay away from those feelings.
"The first time I saw the capital, I was very young. I'd never seen a waterfall before. I thought they were so beautiful. I never thought that one day I'd live in the palace."
"Well, tell me, did you dream of power and politics when you were a little girl?" Again, Padme had to laugh aloud.
"No, that was the last thing I thought of."
She could feel the wistfulness creeping into her, the memories of those long ago days before her innocence had been shattered by war, and even more so, by the constant deceptions and conniving of politics. She could hardly believe that she was opening up to Anakin like this.
"My dream was to work in the refugee relief movement. I never thought of running for elected office. But the more history I studied, the more I realized how much good politicians could do. So when I was 8, I joined the apprentice legislators, which is like making a formal announcement that you're entering public service here in Naboo. From there, I went on to become a senatorial advisor and attacked my duties with such a passion that before I knew it, I was elected queen."
Padme looked at Anakin and shrugged, trying not to throw all humility away. "Partly because I scored so high on my education certificate," she explained. "But for the most part, my ascent was because of my conviction that reform was possible. The people of Naboo embraced that dream wholeheartedly, so much so that my age was hardly an issue in the campaign. I wasn't the youngest queen ever elected, but now that I think back on it, I'm not sure I was old enough." She paused and locked stares with Anakin. "I'm not sure I was ready." "The people you serve thought you did a good job," Anakin reminded her. "I heard they tried to amend the Constitution so that you could stay in office."
"Popular rule is not democracy, Anakin. It gives the people what they want, not what they need. And truthfully, I was relieved when my 2 terms were up."
Padme chuckled as she continued, adding emphasis. "So were my parents. They worried about me during the blockade and couldn't wait for it all to be over. Actually, I was hoping to have a family by now. She turned away a bit, feeling her face flushing. How could she be so open to him and so quickly? He was not a longtime friend, she reminded herself, but the warning sounded hollow in her thoughts. She looked back at Anakin and she felt so at ease, so comfortable with him, almost as if they had been friends for all their lives. "My sister has the most amazing, wonderful kids." Her eyes were sparkling, she knew, but she blinked the emotion away, as Padme had often blinked away her personal desires, for the sake of what she perceived to be the greater good. "But when the Queen asked me to serve as senator, I couldn't refuse her," she explained.
"I agree," Anakin replied. "I think the Republic needs you. I'm glad you chose to serve. I feel things are going to happen in our generation that will change the galaxy in profound ways."
"A Jedi premonition?" Padme kidded. Anakin laughed. "A feeling," he explained, or tried to explain, for it was obvious that he wasn't quite sure what he was trying to say. It just seems to me as if it's all grown stale. As if something has to happen.
I think so, too, Padme put in sincerely.
They had arrived at the great doors of the palace and paused to take in the beautiful scene. Unlike most of Coruscant's buildings, which seemed to have been designed with utter efficiency in mind, this structure was more akin to the Jedi Temple, an understanding that aesthetics were important, that form went hand in hand with purpose. Padme knew her way about the place, obviously, and she was well known by almost all of the people within. And so the two walked along easily to the throne room, where they were announced at once. Smiling faces greeted them. Cio Bibble, Padme's dear friend and her trusted advisor when she was queen, stood by the throne, flanking Queen Jamila, as he had so often flanked Padme. He hadn't aged much over the last years. His white hair and beard still distinguished and perfectly coiffed. His eyes still full of that intensity that Padme so loved. Beside him, Jamila looked every bit the part of queen. She wore a great headdress and flowing embroidered robes, the same type of outfit Padme had worn for so very long. And the senator thought that Jamila looked at least as regal in them as she had. Handmaidens, advisors, and guards were all about. And Padme reflected that one of the side effects of being queen, and not a pleasant one, was that one was never allowed to be alone. Queen Jamila, standing perfectly straight so that her headdress did not topple, rose and walked over to take Padme's hand. "We've been worried about you. I'm so glad you're here, Padme," she said, her voice rich and with a southeastern accent that made her enunciate the consonants powerfully.
"Thank you, Your Highness. I only wish I could have served you better by staying on Coruscant for the vote."
"Supreme Chancellor Palpatine has explained it all," Cio Bibble interjected. "Returning home was the only real choice you could have made."
Padme gave him a resigned nod. Still, being sent home to Naboo bothered her. She had worked so very hard against the creation of a Republic army.
"How many systems have joined Count Dooku and the Separatists?" Queen Jamila asked bluntly. She had never been one for small talk.
"Thousands," Padme answered. "And more are leaving the Republic every day. If the Senate votes to create an army, I'm sure it's going to push us into civil war."
Cio Bibble punched his fist into his open hand.
"It's unthinkable," he said,
gnashing his teeth with every word.
"There hasn't been a full-scale war since the formation of the Republic."
"Do you see any way through negotiations to bring the Separatists back into the Republic?"
Jamila asked, staying calm despite Cio Bibble's obvious agitation. "Not if they feel threatened." It amazed Padme to realize how secure she was in these estimations. She felt as if she was beginning to fully understand the nuances of her position, as if she could trust her instincts implicitly. And all of her talents would be needed, she knew.
"The Separatists don't have an army, but if they are provoked, they will move to defend themselves. I'm sure of that. And with no time or money to build an army, my guess is they will turn to the Commerce Guild or the Trade Federation for help."
"The armies of commerce," Queen Jamila echoed with anger and distaste.
All on Naboo knew well the problems associated with such free-ranging groups. The Trade Federation had nearly brought Naboo to its knees, and would have, had it not been for the heroics of Amidala, a pair of Jedi, a young Anakin, and the brave flying of the dedicated Naboo pilots. Even that would not have been enough, had not Queen Amidala forged an unexpected alliance with the heroic Gungans.
"Why has nothing been done in the Senate to restrain them?"
"I'm afraid that, despite the Chancellor's best efforts, there are still many bureaucrats, judges, and even senators on the payrolls of the guilds," Padme admitted.
"Then it is true that the guilds have moved closer to the Separatists, as we suspected,"
Queen Jamila reasoned. Cio Bibble punched his open palm again, drawing their attention.
"It's outrageous," he said. "It's outrageous that after all those hearings and four trials in the Supreme Court, Newt Gunray is still the Viceroy of the Trade Federation. Do those money-mongers control everything?"
"Remember, Counselor, the courts were able to reduce the Trade Federation's armies,"
Jamila reminded, again holding her calm and controlled voice.
"That's a move in the right direction."
Padme winced.
knowing that she had to report honestly. There are rumors, Your Highness, that the Federation's army was not reduced as they were ordered. Clearing his throat, Anakin Skywalker stepped forward.
The Jedi have not been allowed to investigate, he explained. It would be too dangerous for the economy, we were told.
Queen Jamila looked to him and nodded, looked back to Padme, then squared her shoulders and firmed her jawline, looking regal in the ornate raiments. Very much the planetary ruler, obedient to the Republic.
We must keep our faith in the Republic, she declared. The day we stop believing democracy can work is the day we lose it.
Let's pray that day never comes, Padme quietly answered. In the meantime, we must consider your own safety, Queen Jamila said, and she looked to Seo Bibble, who motioned to the attendants. All of them, advisors, attendants, and handmaidens, bowed and quickly left the room. Seo Bibble moved near to Anakin, the appointed protector, then paused, waiting for all of the others to be gone. At last he spoke.
What is your suggestion, Master Jedi?
Anakin's not a Jedi yet, Counselor, Padme interrupted. He's still a Padawan learner. I was thinking...
Hey, hold on a minute!
Anakin cut her short. His eyes narrowed, brow furrowed, obviously agitated and put off by her dismissal.
Excuse me,
Padme shot right back, not backing down from Anakin's imposing glare. I was thinking I would stay in the Lake Country. There are some places up there that are very isolated.
Excuse me, Anakin said, giving it right back to her, in words and in tone. I am in charge of security here, m'lady.
Padme started to fight back, but she noted then the exchange of suspicious looks between Seo Bibble and Queen Jamila. She and Anakin should not be fighting in this manner in public, she realized, not without making others believe that something might be going on between them. She calmed down and softened her expression and her voice.
Anakin, my life is at risk, and this is my home. I know it very well. That is why we're here. I think it would be wise for you to take advantage of my knowledge in this instance.
Anakin looked around at the two onlookers and then back at Padme, and the hardness melted from his expression. Sorry, m'lady.
She is right. An obviously amused Seo Bibble said, taking Anakin's arm. The Lake Country is the most remote part of Naboo. Not many people up there, and a clear view of the surrounding terrain. It would be an excellent choice, a place where you would have a much easier time protecting Senator Amidala.
Perfect, Queen Jamila agreed. It's settled then.
Padme could tell from the way Anakin was looking at her that he wasn't overly pleased. She offered an innocent shrug in response.
Padme, Queen Jamila went on, I had an audience with your father yesterday. I told him what was happening. He hopes you will visit your mother before you leave. Your family is very worried about you.
How could they not be, Padme thought. And it pained her to consider that the dangers her strong positions were bringing to her were affecting other people whom she loved.
How could they not?
It was a perfect reminder of why family and public service didn't usually mix. Padme Amidala had made a conscious and definitive choice. Public service or family. Some in Naboo juggled the two, but Padme had always known that such a dual role as wife, perhaps even mother, and senator, would not do well for family or state. She hadn't been worried about her own safety at all through these trials, willing to make whatever sacrifices were necessary. But now, suddenly, she had to remember that her choices and positions could affect others on a very personal level as well. She wore no smile as she walked with Anakin, Seo Bibble, and Queen Jamila out of the throne room and down the palace's main staircase. Chapter 13. The largest room in the vast Jedi Temple on Coruscant was the Hall of the Archives. Lighted computer panels stretched out in long, long lines of bluish dots along the walls, running so far that a person viewing them from one end of the room would see them converging at the other end. And throughout were the images of Jedi's past and present, groups of sculpted busts done in white stone by many of the finest artisans of Coruscant. Obi-Wan Kenobi stood at one of these busts, studying it, touching it, as if examining the facial features of the person depicted would give him some insight to the man's motivations. There weren't many visitors in the archives today. There rarely were more than a few, and so the Jedi expected that his call to Madame Jocasta Nu, the Jedi archivist, would be answered shortly. He stood patiently studying the strong features on the bust, the high and proud cheekbones, the meticulous hairstyle, the eyes wide and alert. Obi-Wan hadn't known this man, this legend, Count Dooku, very well. But he had seen him on occasion, and he knew that this bust captured the essence of Dooku perfectly. There was an intensity about the man as palpable as that which had sometimes surrounded Master Qui-Gon, especially when Qui-Gon had found a particularly important cause. Qui-Gon would go against the Jedi Council when he felt that he was right, as he had done with Anakin some 10 years earlier, before the Council had agreed to recognize that the boy's special circumstances, the incredible force potential, and the promise that he might be the one spoken of in prophecy. Yes, Obi-Wan had seen this kind of intensity in Qui-Gon on occasion, but what he knew of Dooku was that, unlike Qui-Gon, the man had never been able to shut it off, had always been stomping around, chewing over an issue. The lights in his eyes were ever-burning fires. But Dooku had taken it to extremes, and dangerous ones, Obi-Wan realized. He had left the Jedi Order, had walked out on his calling and on his peers. Whatever problems Dooku must have seen, he should have recognized that he could better repair them by remaining within the Jedi family.
"Did you call for assistance?"
came a stern voice behind Obi-Wan, drawing him from his thoughts. He turned to see Madame Jocasta Nu standing beside him, her hands folded together before her, practically disappearing within the folds of her Jedi robes. She was a frail-looking creature, quite elderly, and noting that brought a smile to Obi-Wan's face. How many younger and less experienced Jedi had looked upon that facade, the thin and wrinkled face and neck, the white hair tied tight, thinking that they could push the woman around, getting her to do their studying for them, only to encounter the truth that was Jocasta Nu. She was a firebrand, that weak facade hiding her true strength and determination. Jocasta Nu had been the archivist for many, many years, and this was her place, her domain, her kingdom. Any Jedi coming in here, even the most exalted of Jedi masters, would play by the rules of Jocasta Nu, or they would surely face her wrath. "Yes, yes, I did," Obi-Wan finally managed to respond, realizing that Jocasta Nu was staring at him inquisitively, awaiting an answer. The old woman smiled and walked past him to regard the bust of Count Dooku.
"He has a powerful face, doesn't he?"
she commented, her quiet tone taking the tension out of the meeting.
"He was one of the most brilliant Jedi I have had the privilege of knowing."
"I never understood why he quit," Obi-Wan said, following Jocasta Nu's look to the bust. "Only 20 Jedi have ever left the Order."
"The lost 20," Jocasta Nu said with a profound sigh. "And Count Dooku was the most recent and the most painful. No one likes to talk about it. His leaving was a great loss to the Order."
"What happened?"
"Well, one might say he was a bit out of step with the decisions of the Council," the archivist replied. "Much like your old Master Qui-Gon."
Even though Obi-Wan had just been thinking the same thing, somewhat, to hear Jocasta Nu speak the word so definitively caught him off guard, and painted Qui-Gon in a more rebellious light than he had ever considered. He knew that his former master had his moments, of course, the greatest of those being the confrontations concerning Anakin, but he had never thought of Qui-Gon as that much of a rebel. Apparently, Jocasta Nu, who had her finger as squarely as anyone on the pulse of the Jedi Temple, did.
"Really?"
Obi-Wan prompted, wanting the information about Dooku, of course, but also hoping to garner some insight into his old and beloved master.
"Oh, yes, they were alike in many ways. Very individual thinkers. Idealists."
She stared at the bust intently, and it seemed to Obi-Wan as if she had suddenly gone far, far away.
He was always striving to become a more powerful Jedi. He wanted to be the best. With the lightsaber, in the old style of fencing, he had no match. His knowledge of the Force was unique. In the end, I think he left because he lost faith in the Republic. He believed that politics were corrupt.
Jocastinu paused for a moment and looked at Obi-Wan, a very revealing expression that showed she did not think Dooku as out of step, as many of the others apparently did.
And he felt that the Jedi betrayed themselves by serving the politicians, the archivist stated.
Obi-Wan blinked, soaking in the words. He knew that many, Qui-Gon included, even himself included at times, often felt the same way.
He always had very high expectations of government, Jocastinu went on. He disappeared for 9 or 10 years, then just showed up recently as the head of the separatist movement.
Interesting, Obi-Wan remarked, looking from the bust to the archivist. I'm still not sure I understand.
None of us does, Jocastinu replied,
her serious expression melting into a warm smile.
Well, I'm sure you didn't call me over here for a history lesson. Are you having a problem, Master Kenobi?
Yes. I'm trying to find a planet system called Kamino. It doesn't seem to show up on any of the archive charts.
Kamino.
Jocastinu looked around, as if she was searching for the system right then and there.
It's not a system I'm familiar with. Let me see.
A few steps brought them to the computer screen where Obi-Wan had been searching. She bent low and pressed a couple of commands.
Are you sure you have the right coordinates?
According to my information, it should be in this quadrant somewhere, said Obi-Wan, just south of the Rishi Maze. A few more taps of the keyboard brought nothing more than a frown to Jocastinu's old and weathered face.
But what are the exact coordinates?
I only know the quadrant, Obi-Wan admitted, and Jocastinu turned up to regard him.
No coordinates? Sounds like the sort of directions you'd get from a street tout, some old miner or furbog trader.
All three, actually, Obi-Wan admitted with a grin.
Are you sure it exists?
Absolutely. Jocastinu sat back and rubbed a hand pensively over her chin.
Let me do a gravitational scan, she said, as much to herself as to Obi-Wan.
The star map hologram of the target quadrant went into motion after a few more keystrokes, and the pair studied the movements.
There are some inconsistencies here, the sharp archivist noted. Maybe the planet you're seeking was destroyed.
Wouldn't that be on record?
It ought to be, unless it was very recent,
Jocastinu replied, but she was shaking her head even as she spoke the words, not even convincing herself.
I hate to say it, but it looks like the system you're searching for doesn't exist.
That's impossible. Perhaps the archives are incomplete.
The archives are comprehensive and totally secure, my young Jedi,
came the imposing response. The archivist stepping back from her familiarity with Obi-Wan and assuming again the demeanor of Archive Kingdom ruler.
One thing you may be absolutely sure of. If an item does not appear in our records, it does not exist.
The two stared at each other for a long moment, Obi-Wan taking note that there wasn't the slightest tremor of doubt in Jocastinu's declaration. He looked back to the map, perplexed, caught within a seemingly unanswerable question. He knew that no one in the galaxy was more reliable for information than Dexter Jetster, unless that person was Jocastinu. And yet the two were obviously at odds here, concerning their information. Dexter had seemed every bit as certain of the origins of the saber dart as Jocastinu was now. Both couldn't be right. The puzzle of finding Senator Amidala's would-be assassin would not be easily solved, it seemed. And that troubled Obi-Wan Kenobi for many, many reasons. With Jocasta Nu's permission, the Jedi punched a few buttons on the keyboard, downloading the archive information on that region of the quadrant to a small hologlobe. Then, the item in hand, he left the area. But not without one long last look at the imposing bust of Count Dooku. Later on that day, Obi-Wan turned away from the archives and the analysis droids and turned within, to his own insights instead. He found a small comfortable room along the temple's grand balcony, one of many such rooms designed for quiet moments of Jedi reflection. A small fountain bubbled off to the side of him as he settled on a soft but firm mat and crossed his legs. The water trickled down to a bed of polished stones, making a delicate sound, a background noise, natural in its beauty and in the simplicity of its song. Before Obi-Wan, a painting of reds shifting and darkening to a deep crimson and then to black, a liberal representation of a cooling lava field hung on the wall, inviting him not to look into it, but to surround himself with it, both its image and the soft warmth and hissing sound, helping him to fall far away from his corporeal surroundings. There in his trance, Obi-Wan Kenobi sought his answers. He focused on the mystery of Kamino first, expecting that Dexter's analysis was correct. But why hadn't the system shown up in the archives? Another image invaded Obi-Wan's meditations as he tried to sort through that puzzle. An image of Anakin and Padme together on Naboo. The Jedi Knight started, suddenly afraid that this was a premonition, and that some danger would visit his Padawan and the young senator. But no, he realized, settling back. No danger was about. The two were relaxed and at play. Obi-Wan's relief lasted only as long as it took him to realize that the continuing scene in his mind might be the most dangerous thing of all. He dismissed it, though, unsure if this was a premonition, an image of reality, or just his own fears playing out before him. Obi-Wan pointedly reminded himself that the sooner he solved the mystery of Kamino, the mystery of who so desperately wanted Amidala dead, the sooner he could return to Anakin and offer the proper guidance. The Jedi Knight focused again on the bust of Count Dooku, searching for insights. But for some reason, the image of Anakin kept becoming interposed with that of the renegade Count. Soon after, a frustrated and thoroughly bewildered Obi-Wan walked out of the small meditation chamber, shaking his head, and no more certain of anything than he had been when he had entered the place. His patience exhausted into frustration, the Jedi Knight decided to seek a higher authority, one wiser and more experienced. His short trip took him out of the temple proper and onto the veranda, and there he paused and watched, and in the innocent scene before him, found some relief from the frustration. Master Yoda was leading 20 of the youngest Jedi recruits, children only 4 or 5 years old, through their morning training exercises, battling floating training droids with miniature lightsabers. Obi-Wan recalled his own training. He couldn't see the eyes of the youngsters, for they wore protective full-face helmets, but he could well imagine the range of emotions playing out on their innocent faces. There would be intensity, and then great joy, whenever an energy bolt from a training droid was blocked. And that elation would inevitably dissipate in the next instant, when the joy brought distraction, and distraction allowed the next energy bolt to slip past and bring a sudden jolting sting. And those little bolts did sting, Obi-Wan remembered, as much physically as in pride. There was nothing worse than getting zapped, particularly in the backside. It always caused one to do a little hopping and twisting dance, which naturally made the embarrassment all the worse. Obi-Wan recalled that feeling vividly, recalled thinking that everyone in the courtyard was staring at him. The training could be humiliating. But it was